Welcome, Friends of Wildlife, to Protect Our Wildlife's podcast, Untamed. I am Brenna Galdenzi, and I'm the president and co-founder of Protect Our Wildlife, Vermont's number one all-volunteer wildlife protection nonprofit organization. The animals only have us, and we take being their voice seriously. Today in our second episode, I'll be talking with Chris Shadler. Chris has a master's in conservation biology and has researched wild canids, including wolves and coyotes, for 30 years. She taught at University of New Hampshire for a few decades and is now retired and gives coyote talks throughout New England. She had sheep for 20 years, which is how she got most of her coyote education. Chris learned to think like a coyote in order to keep her sheep safe. Chris is also co-founder of the New Hampshire Wildlife Coalition. To learn more about them, visit them at nhwildlifecoalition.org, and you can also find them on Facebook. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Brenna.
I heard you guys got some major snow where you are in New Hampshire. I'm in northern Vermont. We didn't get much, but southern Vermont, I want to say, got close to 2 feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got a little bit over 2 feet. I think Claremont got 43 inches. And I was out there yesterday and today plowing through the snow, and I was watching my own dogs flounder. And my dogs are about the size of an average coyote. And it made me think how difficult life must be for them right now with rodents just out of reach. Deer really not able to move very well at all in this, you know, this kind of snow really impacts wildlife on many different levels. And then in addition to that, of course, there's trapping and hunting, which is an additive mortality, really, in times like this.
That's a really good point, and not one that I thought about today when I was hearing about the snow and how it might be impacting, you know, not only coyotes but you know deer and all kinds of animals. So that leads me, Chris, you know, talking about your background, you know, being a sheep farmer and how you had to learn to think like a coyote in order to protect your sheep. Is that when you first got involved with coyotes? Was it your sheep that caused you to become more interested in learning about them and their behavior? And
yeah, it really was. I had been out in the Midwest for a while, and I had studied wolves when I was out there. And that was during the time that wolves were, you know, they had just been protected. And I was interested to see how humans would adjust to those wolves. Well, then my husband and I wound up on the East Coast, which is really where I'm from anyway. And someone gave me a border collie, of all things. And then the border collie didn't know what to do with itself. So I got it some sheep. And then sheep lead to more sheep. And before I knew it, I had a whole flock. And I became acutely aware that there were coyotes out here that were part wolf, mostly coyote, and maybe a touch of dog. And I became very interested in the character of this animal, which is so different from wolves. It's a much more interesting animal, actually. But we ended up buying a farm in New Hampshire that had been plagued by coyote predation on this guy's sheep. So I was moving my sheep into a situation where the coyotes were already tuned into how good lamb can taste, for example. So I had to get smart as quickly as was possible. And I decided to do it by really getting into the mind and the ecology of coyotes and try to learn how to coexist with them, which I was able to do.
You know, I could definitely envision maybe a future podcast to talk about, you know, some of those methods that you used to deter coyotes from, you know, preying on your sheep. Being in Vermont, we are an agricultural state, so we certainly have a lot of sheep farmers and people who keep goats and chickens and cows. And that's one of the major things that we hear from people is, you know, how do I protect my livestock, not only from coyotes, but from, you know, other carnivores? And I think some of what you've learned and what you've employed in New Hampshire could really be helpful here to folks in Vermont.
Yeah, I love talking to farmers. And I'm actually doing a Zoom workshop for the Vermont Grazing and Livestock Group in January. They're having their conference. So I'm really looking forward to that. It takes a real dedication, you know, in order to coexist. But in the 20 years that I had sheep, I never lost a sheep to the coyotes that I was living with. And they, I knew, were dyed-in-the-wool sheep killers because it had become so easy for them. So anytime you want to do that, I would love that.
And that presentation that you're attending is in January?
Yes.
That's great. If you can get us the details on that, I'd love to advertise it with our members here in Vermont.
Sure.
You know, how I got involved with coyotes is definitely a different, you know, took a different path than how you first became involved. You know, when Protect Our Wildlife first started back in January of 2015, coyotes really weren't a species that we were going to cover. We were really focused primarily on educating the public about the dangers and cruelties of trapping and, you know, trying to focus our energies on getting that banned. And it wasn't until one of my friends started the Vermont Coyote Coexistence Coalition, and she and some other wildlife advocates were kind of going through social media and capturing examples of, you know, just how terrible people treat coyotes and, you know, gathering evidence, because in order to push forward policy changes or anything like that, you know, you need to prove that there's a problem. And, you know, we often hear too much that, oh, it's just a few bad apples, you know, who kill coyotes and do unethical things. But what they found and what we found over the past couple of years is that there really seems to be just this terrible culture of loathing and misunderstanding here in Vermont, you know, directed at coyotes. And I think the first step is to just collect evidence of a problem and then figure out how you're going to work forward in changing the laws. So I'll go through some of the concerns we had later in our conversation. But yeah, that's just a much different entry point for me into the work, but it still leads to the same end goal, is to, you know, encourage people to better understand coyotes, why they do the things they do, how can we coexist? And that's why I'm so thankful that you can take your time and talk with us and talk with our members, because we think coexistence is certainly possible. So the coyotes in the Northeast look very different from those that we see out west. Much smaller, fluffier, it seems like. You know, we've seen some coyotes here in Vermont that look very wolfy, but they also look very dog-like, probably more in their coloring. We've seen ones even with some white patches. And so can you explain a bit more about the different color variations of coyotes and what the eastern coyote here is actually made up of?
Sure. And that's part of what makes this animal so incredibly persistent on the landscape. It is 60 to 70% Western coyote. It is a coyote. It's not a subspecies of the Western coyote. It's a coyote, but it's an enhanced coyote, and it's enhanced with wolf DNA, primarily the Eastern wolf that resides in Algonquin Park. And that, you know, that in and of itself is its own story. But so about 60 to 70% Western coyote, anywhere from 0 to 30% wolf, 0 to 30%. And depending, you know, from animal to animal, there's going to be a certain amount of dog DNA in there as well. Where the dog DNA comes from could be anywhere from out west, trickling down through generations to the animals that we have here. or it could be from a mating here. Although I'll take this opportunity right now to say that there is not, nor can there be, a population of a thing called a coy dog. A coy dog is the product of a mating between coyotes, a coyote and a dog, and their offspring can breed, but they most oftentimes breed with another dog. So that means that the coyote-ness in that offspring is going to become less and less over time, and the dog part is going to become greater and greater. And it's more complicated than that, but there can be no sustained population of coy dogs. So it's a misnomer, really, to call them coy dogs. They're really so much more than that. They are an eastern coyote, which means coyote, wolf, and some dog.
Yeah, we still hear a lot of people referring to coyotes here in Vermont as coy dogs. So I'm glad that you addressed that. There's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding about coyotes, and that's one of them. And, you know, we think about here in Vermont, we wear blaze orange and we have our dogs wear blaze orange during the hunting seasons, mostly in November. But what's really scary is that there was a dog that was shot last week here in Vermont. It was a husky mix, and it was mistaken for a coyote. She was in her yard on posted land out in a field, and her owner thinks that she was mistaken for a coyote. You know, with hunting season for coyotes, I think typically, I mean, people will kill coyotes when they're out deer hunting or turkey hunting in the spring. But we know that at least in Vermont, and I think in New York State and probably New Hampshire as well, the hounders kind of start up hunting in the winter months. And when there's no other seasons really going on right now, when deer season is finally over, a lot of them switch over to coyote hunting. So it was really a reminder for me to make sure that my dogs are wearing orange, you know, even into the winter months, because some of these dogs, if they're husky mixes or especially German Shepherd mixes, they can definitely look coyote-like, especially given all the different variations of coyotes I've seen, eastern coyotes I've seen in Vermont with, again, different coloring. And one thing actually I want to ask you, Chris, now that I have you here, is it possible for coyotes to ever have kind of floppy ears, or are their ears always erect? Because there was a quote unquote coyote that was killed a couple years ago by a coyote hunter, and it looked like the dog had its ears were flopping. And in the photo, he was holding the ears up, but it was very clear that the dog's ears were not erect. So can coyotes ever have floppy ears, or are their ears always erect?
Well, because they have dog in them, it is possible for coyotes to have floppy ears, but it's very rare. And I didn't completely answer the question that you had asked me, which is about their coloration. They can be anywhere from very close to whitish to very close to charcoal gray or even black. And that is because they are bearing the genetic material of not just wolves, but dogs. So anybody who owns a husky really needs to pony up and deck their dog out in orange. Absolutely. And I agree about German Shepherds as well. And it's just, you know, it's criminal, really, that people can mistakenly kill somebody's dog because they thought it was a coyote. And I don't know, you know, whether you're going to be asking me at all about the ethics of year-round killing of coyotes, but may I take a moment to talk about that right now?
Of course. You know, I'm always interested in talking about the ethics or lack of ethics in killing coyotes. So have at it.
So, you know, as a person who has been trained as a scientist, and my teaching career was, you know, within the natural resources department at UNH. I typically made my conservation arguments based upon science, in fact, and it's very important for people to get their facts absolutely right when they're defending a species. But when it comes to coyotes, as you pointed out, Brenna, they are so reviled. 43 of 49 states allow year-round hunting of this animal. And most of them allow nighttime hunting between January and March, which is their breeding season. There is no way that a fish and game agency can call this conservation. This is a sporting opportunity for those people who want to just go out and kill. And I think that it is wrong to use words like harvest. They're not harvesting these animals. They're just killing them. And we have found coyote dumps where these groups that have gone out to hunt them or hound them, once the animals are killed and counted in a contest, say, the animals are just dumped in the woods, just like garbage. And I can't imagine that there is a biologist at a fish and game agency who can actually defend that in any kind of moral or ethical ground. Period. Now, the second part of this is that I think that wildlife advocates should not be afraid to make a statement, a strong and passionate statement, about whether wildlife should ever be treated in this way. It goes for, you know, anything that is going to be shot, but to kill an animal just for the sake of killing an animal should not be allowed by a decent population, in my view. And, you know, obviously, I've been at this a really long time. I have not been able, using science and biology and ecology, I have not been able to convince fish and game commissions, which are the ones that set the rules. It's the commissions. I've not been able to convince our commission here in New Hampshire to change its mind about stopping killing contests, stopping nighttime hunting of coyotes. We've been unsuccessful in putting even a season on the animal. And yet most hunters do not hunt coyotes. It is a small fraction of the hunting community that is interested in killing for the sake of killing. So, you know, I implore those of us that care about wildlife to contact those hunters who do have a sense of right and wrong and really true conservation about killing animals to help us in this initiative.
You know, I share in your frustration about the fish and wildlife departments, because they always pride themselves on using, and as they should, science to inform wildlife policy. But that's not the case with the open season, no bag limits, night and day hunting of coyotes. And the rationale that they provided, because we've asked, and don't quote me on this exactly, but it seems to be that if the open season on coyotes, you know, this unregulated, relentless killing doesn't negatively impact their populations, the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department doesn't really feel that they need to do anything.
Oh, so that is exactly what they say here. Yes, that's exactly what they say. And in that sense, the coyote is its own worst enemy, because it is indefatigable. You can kill coyotes and kill coyotes. They've tried to eradicate coyotes in certain Western states. They've tried to do it for over 100 years, and they have failed. And for that reason, they think that this gives them a license to allow these animals to be willy-nilly killed. So that is why the public have to become aware that there's no scientific basis for this kind of killing, and it is not a justification. It is not legitimate to say, you know, we're not hurting the population. In fact, you may be encouraging the population to grow more quickly by doing this, because it upsets the balance within PACs.
And as a, you know, Fish and Wildlife Department that is statutorily required, you know, to, and the word is protect wildlife for the benefit of all Vermonters, you know, I really think that they're falling short on that, because just because you can kill coyotes, you know, day and night, 365 days of the year, it doesn't mean that it's ethically sound. And it's really been very discouraging that we can't get Fish and Wildlife to try and help us elevate hunting ethics around coyotes. Now, they did not support a ban on the open season. They really, as far as I know, haven't supported a ban on wanton waste to include coyotes. We had that effort underway in the legislature earlier this year. So we figure, okay, well, if they're not going to push for better management or policy, then can they at the very least start a educational campaign on coyotes? Start with youth hunters at conservation camps, you know, teach kids about, you know, coyote family structure and how there's a mated pair and, you know, they form very tight family bonds and how, you know, they're important on our landscapes, and just trying to get to the root of this, again, this culture of deep loathing and hatred towards these animals that is so very dangerous. And Vermont Fish and Wildlife has the power to start hosting presentations. They can do Zoom presentations. They can do podcasts. They can do a wide variety of things. But to just turn a blind eye and pretend that these things aren't happening is beyond disappointing. I mean, well, as you and I always do, Chris, we're totally off off the script, but that's just how you and I operate. So I'm just going to talk about this really quick. Earlier this month, we received an email from one of our members, and she was driving down a pretty busy road here in Vermont, and she saw two, what used to be very healthy, fluffy coyotes hanging from a tree. And, you know, she said, what can I do about this? Who should I call? And we've been down this road before. And since there is no ban on wanton waste, there's not much that you can do. And to my knowledge, those coyotes have been hanging there on those trees now for weeks. And so when we have just such blatant disregard for life, such as that, and Fish and Wildlife still fails to see that we have a problem. You know, we had another one of our members was out walking. He was on a public trail, and off the trail, he saw about five or six coyotes nailed to a tree. And the tree was adorned with all skulls of cows, and there were five or six coyotes that were just nailed to the tree. And he contacted the game warden. And again, you know, nothing can be done, because you can do whatever you want to coyotes. And, you know, there's no laws that prevent this, you know, wasteful, hateful activity. And that's a problem. And I think a lot of that can be mitigated by education. And it's not going to change in a year or two. It's going to need to be, you know, years worth of dedicated outreach and education, you know, by the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department to address what's happening out there, because we just can't go on with this business as usual, because more and more people are just not tolerating it.
Well, I'm disgusted by your stories. That's a real painful thing to hear. And, you know, it's such an insult to people who don't necessarily share that worldview of the guy that would demonstrate in that way. I agree with you about education. There are a variety of ways of tackling this thing. But recently, and I don't know if this is true in Vermont, we have had an influx of brand new people from the New York area, New Jersey, Connecticut, who have bought land or bought a house here in New Hampshire and are completely unaware of how to live in the country. And I've been thinking a lot about this. I've been thinking about, you know, asking newspapers in New Hampshire if I can do, you know, sort of weekly column about how to live in the country. And I know that my recommendations for how to live in the country is going to bring a lot of negative comments from those people that want to just use the land any old way they want to use it. But with these new people coming in and not understanding how country people live, for good or for not so good, I think it would be useful to recognize the fact that, you know, it takes a little bit of skill to live effectively in the country.
Back on the influx of people from Massachusetts and Connecticut and New York and other states moving to Vermont, I have to say that it's been our experience that they are so excited to see wildlife, whether it's a black bear or a fox or a coyote. And I think that it would really be in Fish and Wildlife's best interest to help elevate the image of hunting by addressing a lot of these bad actors, by cleaning up some of these terrible laws they have on coyotes, because people that move here, they may respect, you know, Vermont's deep hunting culture, you know, where you go out there and you hunt deer and you do it for food and you do it with respect for the life taken. I don't think anybody has a problem with that. But these people that are moving up here, when they see coyotes, you know, dangling from a tree, or, you know, they see a bunch of hounds run down a coyote and maul it, they are not going to take too kindly to that. And I think we're going to see a major uptick in land getting posted. We're going to see a reduction in the general public supporting hunting in general, because most people will not separate, you know, coyote hunting from deer hunting. They're just going to say, oh, you know, this hunting is terrible. So I really think that it is in the hunter's best interest and in Fish and Wildlife's best interest to put some better safeguards around what's happening to coyotes, because after about 4 years of monitoring what's happening in Vermont, I mean, it is nothing short of nightmarish. And there are photos and videos and comments from Vermont coyote hunters to substantiate that. And it's really their game to lose. The hunters and Fish and Wildlife. You know, this is the image, the reputation of hunting in Vermont, and it will be tarnished if they allow, you know, these bad actors that are more than a few, you know, to continue on with business as usual. Chris, before we, because again, you and I could just talk and talk and talk, and which is great. I don't want to forget to talk about what all of this killing, this random, reckless, unregulated killing does to the coyote population. So a lot of these coyote killers are doing it under the assumption that, you know, killing as many coyotes as they can, that's going to help reduce the coyote population. And it seems as though, despite even the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department countering that, they still continue on killing every coyote they see. So can you just explain to us, you know, coyotes' reproductive biology, how they respond to mass killing?
Sure. So the coyotes in the East are territorial animals, and a territory is occupied by one pack of coyotes with a dominant male and female who are the only breeders in that pack. A pack is a family group. So when breeding season begins in January, let's say a male that has dispersed from his pack will find a female, possibly, and will breed, and then they will move to an area that has not been, that's not been occupied by another pack, if they can find such an area. And they'll mark that area. They will, that area then will provide all the food and the den sites and the cover that that pair and ultimately their family needs. So 63 days after they breed, they give birth to a litter of pups, usually 4 to 6 pups. And the den is used until the pups are weaned. Then the pups are moved to a safe spot on territory. And at that point, mom and dad are bringing food to the pups. Hopefully it is, you know, rodents and the food that they should normally be eating, not sheep, and nothing, you know, else, not, no dog or anything like that. And as long as that pack stays together, unexploited, meaning that they don't lose any members to being killed, the only ones that will breed the following year are going to be mom and dad. Now, if either parent are killed, it will free up some of the yearling males and females to begin to breed. The females and males, the brothers and sisters, won't breed among themselves, but any dispersing male could breed with 1 or 2 or 3 of the females that are in that pack. If both parents had been on board and alive, they would have prohibited any of their daughters from breeding. The critical reason for this is a territory has all the food that a pack needs. And so therefore, the amount of prey in that territory controls naturally the number of coyotes that can be sustained on that territory. That is the really critical part. And so coyotes, on the one hand, they regulate their own population. But on the other hand, they, as you say, Brenna, are ready to respond. If members of the pack are eliminated, they will respond by breeding. And oftentimes, the litters that are produced are much larger than 4 to 6. And I don't want to get into the weeds on this. We can do that in another podcast. But killing coyotes, we know that killing coyotes only results in more coyotes. And one more fact about this, these hunters that willy-nilly kill coyotes, they do it because of the false impression that coyotes are going to hurt the deer herd. There was a study done in the last year in the Northeast on this very thing, and it showed that in no states in the Northeast has the deer herd been harmed by any coyote predation. So even though coyotes take deer, it's not enough to even count.
I hear all of this from you, and I have to say that, and I suspect that the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department biologists would agree with you.
They do.
And what I just don't understand is why we can't have, whether it's, again, a podcast or Zoom webinars, if we can have, you know, in-person presentations, you know, next year, why this is not more broadly communicated. You know, I fear that the information that you provided will fall on deaf ears, you know, to those members of the community who we really need to reach the most. That's why, you know, we've just been urging the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department to, you know, start hosting more educational events and presentations that talk about this, just as you've explained it, because, you know, we're all about, you know, science-based wildlife management. And we're also about ethics of hunting. And this open season killing on coyotes is neither. And I think, you know, we're going to continue with presentations, partnering with you more in the future. And we're going to continue to urge Fish and Wildlife to do so as well, because they have the resources. Whereas, you know, we're an all-volunteer nonprofit, you know, and we do a lot, you know, we are limited in what we're able to do. And really, this messaging should come from the State Fish and Wildlife Department. So we'll continue pushing them. But until then, Chris, you know, this information, you know, that you provided is so important, and we'll continue to get the word out there.
Yeah, good. I hope so.
And you did. I was going to ask you about the territorial nature of coyotes. We've already addressed that. You know, that's something that I always found really interesting, you know, is that they will, you know, they'll defend that that territory against other coyotes. So, you know, I forget what you had said it was, if it's 3 or 4 miles, you know, they'll defend that against, you know, other coyotes coming in. So really, you know, a landscape can only accommodate, you know, so many coyotes. They're not going to allow, you know, any other coyotes in. And that's something that I think gets overlooked a lot. In a lot of these discussions I see, whether it's on social media or, you know, someplace else. So is there anything else that we didn't talk about in this podcast? Or I'm thinking maybe for the next podcast, it might be a good idea to talk a bit more again about, you know, the Eastern coyote, you know, and maybe more of the background on how they got here, but also help advise wildlife advocates, whether they're in New Hampshire or Vermont or, you know, in other states, you know, what they can do to get involved locally, you know, to be better wildlife advocates or better coyote advocates. So maybe that's something we can talk about in the future. Is there anything else that you kind of wanted to leave with?
I think that it takes a certain worldview to want to coexist. I think it takes humility. And, you know, I could talk for an hour about how important I think it is to be humble when it comes to understanding, really, that we must learn to live with the creatures that are out there. We need them. We need coyotes. You know, they're good rodent control. They have a legitimate place in the ecosystem. They're not an invasive species. Vermont Fish and Wildlife really has it right, as does New Hampshire Fish and Game. The biologists understand the value of the animal. It is, as you say, Brenna, it is the culture, and it's really a subculture of people who will nail coyotes to a tree. That's an angry person, and it's an assault, really, on all of the people in that area who find it repulsive. And so, you know, there's much to talk about here. And I would love to hear questions from people and concerns from people that, you know, we could just run through in our next podcast.
That's a really good idea. So what I can do is, after folks have listened to this podcast, if they have any questions or any, you know, follow-ups that they would like us to cover on a future podcast, I'm really excited to do that. People can email us at info@protectourwildlifevt.org. And again, since we've kind of gone off script, which I love, I forgot to mention some of these common refrains that we hear a lot from coyote killers in Vermont. And we've been keeping track of a lot of them. And this just really sums up, you know, why we are doing what we're doing and why we need people who are concerned to really get involved. You know, these are the types of comments, and I'll read them to you. I don't care what season I'm hunting. It's always coyote season. I'll kill every coyote I see until the day I die. Trap them, shoot them, drag them, drown them. Only good yotes, a dead yote. I mean, those are three of probably, I don't even want to guess, hundreds of comments that wildlife advocates have collected from Vermont coyote killers. I don't even call them hunters. So this is why we can never stop talking about coyotes and why we can never stop exposing what's happening, because it's only through education and exposing this cruel behavior, I think, that the general public will say enough and demand better. So Chris, as always, I appreciate my time with you. I can't wait until next year and we can start having you come to Vermont again and host in-person presentations. If things allow, hopefully things with COVID get better maybe in the summer, because I really think that people benefit tremendously from seeing you and listening to you in person. You can't help but to be energized when people hear you. But until then, we will keep posting these podcasts and people know where to reach us. And again, don't forget, if you're in New Hampshire and you want to get involved more with New Hampshire wildlife advocacy, please look up the New Hampshire Wildlife Coalition. You can find them on Facebook. You can also visit them at nhwildlifecoalition.org. And Chris, thank you again. Until next time, my friend.
Thank you, Brenna. I loved it.
Good night, everybody.